With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Two neighbors from the same village fall in love and elope to a shelter for couples that break caste norms. A Hindu woman falls in love with a Muslim man, drawing the ire of Hindu nationalists. Two women start a lesbian relationship together. These three couples are the protagonists of Mansi Choksi's The Newlyweds, Rearranging Marriage in Modern India. This book charts the lives of Dawinder and Neetu, Monica and Arif, Reshma and Preeti, who all break social norms in their relationships and are forced to endure the sometimes violent consequences, not always successfully. Mansi Choksi is a graduate of the Columbia School of Journalism and two-time Livingston Award finalist. Her writing has appeared in The New York Times, The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, National Geographic, The Atlantic, and more. She lives in Dubai with her husband and son, and The Newlyweds is her first book. Today, Mansi and I talk about the three couples in her book and what their struggles tell us about love, relationships, and social pressure in today's India. So, Mansi, thank you so much for coming up for coming on the show. I want to start with maybe just a question about your process of writing the book, which is, you know, how did you find these three couples and what, how did you find these three couples and what drove you to write a whole book about them?
Thanks so much for having me, Nicholas. This book began as a magazine piece for Harper's. I had heard about the Love Commandos several years earlier. The Love Commandos were featured on a very popular Indian TV show called Satyamev Jayate, which is, you know, sort of India's equivalent of Oprah. And Satyamev Jayate had run an episode, you know, describing the Love Commandos' work as, you know, a group of men that, you know, put their lives at great risk to protect young Indians who wanted to marry for love, but feared doing that because of, you know, social consequences. So I actually went in trying to do a piece on the Love Commandos, and I wasn't the first person that had spent time with the Love Commandos. They're written about widely. And I really went in thinking that I was going to write a particular kind of story. And as I spent more time at the Love Commando shelter, I started to learn that, at least I had a feeling that the story was something else. As I spent more time at the Love Commando shelter, it became clearer that, in fact, this was a group of vigilantes that had discovered that there was money to be made, you know, in this idea of Indian modernity. And as long as they kept couples at the shelter, donations would keep pouring in from people who wanted to support intercaste and interreligious marriage, you know, largely, you know, Western people and, you know, the diaspora. When I went to the shelter in 2016, it was the winter of 2016. That's when I first met Neetu and Davinder. And when I sat down to talk to them, I instantly fell in love with Neetu. I just thought she was fantastic in a way that her story and her personality summed up, you know, a part of, you know, a kind of India that we don't really see in, you know, mainstream news and, you know, stories that I thought that she embodied a kind of story that kind of slips out of the cracks of the kind of narratives that come out of India. For what I mean by that is that she's a young woman that is raised in a small village and, you know, always sees herself as the kind of girl that is meant for bigger and better things and bigger and better places. She sort of sees herself as the protagonist in a Hindi film that nobody's watching. And, you know, I just thought the aspirational aspect of her personality was something that is so relatable in the India that I grew up in, but you know, not really captured in books and magazine pieces that I was reading. So that's actually what drove me to spending more time with Neetu and Davinder. So I hung out with them for a few weeks at the Love Commando shelter. And then this magazine piece was accepted, and then I returned to spend time with them. That's how I met Neetu and Davinder. After the magazine piece came out, I realized that I really loved writing this piece, and there was something about this particular topic that had drawn me to it. You know, India has one of the world's largest populations of young people. It is a country that, you know, is every city, village that you visit in India, you get a sense that this is a really young place. And it's also what's interesting about this particular demographic is that it is entirely different in terms of social, political exposure from their parents' generation. We grew up at a time, you know, when the economy was liberalizing, you know, with the advent of internet and social media. And just, you know, we grew up with a sense that we were in a really ascendant part of the world. We're set to be the next superpower. So there's this great optimism that I think a lot of us who grew up in the late 80s and onwards carry with us. And, you know, as we've come of age, those dreams have taken a downward turn in terms, you know, like the economy hasn't been able to develop at the pace that we imagined. And more than that, modernity has a really complex meaning in India. It can mean several things to several people. What was interesting to me is that in many ways, our young people are not different from our parents' generation. A survey was conducted not long ago where a lot of young people said that they opposed intercaste marriage, they opposed marrying for love, they opposed you know, marrying outside of communities and religious lines. And I thought that was really interesting because we had all the factors and kind of conditions to think differently, but that didn't really happen. You know, the six people that I follow in this book are exactly the kind of young Indians that have a really deep sense of filial duty, and are raised to not surpass boundaries of tradition. Yeah, so I wanted to focus on young people, and that's what drew me to the book. But to answer your question, the second couple, Monica and Arif, I found because I went deliberately looking for a couple that would say something larger about India. I wanted to write a book that uses the love story as a vehicle to explore the larger themes shaping India. So one was Neetu and Davinder, who were telling me something about the state of caste prejudice in modern India, while also telling me something about, you know, a group of men that had, you know, created a niche in this capitalist economy. So now I wanted to look for someone that could say something about India's lurch to the right. And I thought, I was reading in the news constantly about couples that were being entangled in the idea of love jihad, which is a narrative that is pushed by the Hindu right wing, a conspiracy theory that says that young Muslim men lure Hindu women into marriage and conversion in order to water down the Hindu majority. So I went looking for them. I read a news snippet about Monica and Arif in one of the newspapers, and I tracked them down and I asked them if I could spend time with them. So that's how that happened. And then I also went searching for Reshma and Preeti. I wanted to write a story about same-sex love, which could illustrate something larger about India's colonial history and, Section 377, which is a legislation that has, stayed on despite several years of independence, and just the idea of how colonial history has affected the way that young LGBT people in India, express their identities and their love for each other. But I wanted to make a deliberate effort to look for not a same-sex couple from a big city, but from, as they say, the margins of society. I wanted to look for women. I wanted to look for working class women. And I wanted to look for women that did not come from big cities. So that's how I ended up with Reshma and Preeti.
So there's a lot there that I want to get into, and I definitely want to focus on this idea of how these social norms kind of still kind of persist today. But I did want to maybe start by talking about Davinder and Neetu, and specifically asking, what was the social norm that their relationship broke? Why were they forced to elope and run to the shelter? I mean, because they're next door neighbors. You feel like falling in love with the girl next door is like kind of such a standard trope outside of this context. So what norm in effect did these two people break when they decided to run away together?
Yeah. So there's a couple of norms that they break by being together. One is that they come from different religious communities. Davinder is Sikh and Neetu is a Hindu. They might seem, it's common to believe that Sikhism comes under the Hindu fold, but in villages this is a pretty vast difference. The second thing is that they come from different castes. Davinder comes from a lower caste compared to Neetu, which is marginally lower caste. So it's a very complex kind of structure of hierarchy, of castes. But they come from different castes, which places Neetu's family at a higher stature. The third thing is wealth and class. Neetu's family is wealthier. Her father is a landlord who has his own firewood shop. I've been spending too much time with my toddler. Firewood shop. Davinder's father is a truck driver who has spent most of his life driving freight trucks. So class is also a massive difference. But most importantly, it is the fact that they are from the same village. According to Indian rural custom, especially from the region that they come from, men and women from the same village are considered to be brothers and sisters. That is, it kind of puts their relationship under the umbrella of incest in many ways. There's a saying, about such relationships in rural India that you marry outside of your religion, marry outside of caste, marry a cripple, marry an old man, but don't marry someone from the same village, because it is believed that this is your brother or sister. So that is one big taboo that they were breaking by being together.
So that's the story of Davinder and Neetu. I'd like to now move on to the second couple of your book, which is, Monica and Arif, which is kind of tied to this conspiracy theory of love jihad that really kind of, I'm going to use the word energizes, but I don't feel like that's the best word to use, but energize a lot of right-wing Hindu nationalists. I wonder if you might talk about what this conspiracy theory of love jihad actually is, and how that affected kind of Monica and Arif's relationship.
Yeah. So love jihad is a conspiracy theory that is not new. It's been around since the 1920s, when the Hindutva movement was first being solidified. It kind of, it can be traced back to writings of prominent Hindu nationalist leaders who essentially talked about the defilement of two sacred symbols. In their mind, those two symbols are cows and women. So love jihad essentially says that Muslim men lure and marry Hindu women, as in make promises of false love, lure Hindu women into marriage, get them pregnant, and create more Muslim children in order to water down the Hindu majority and eventually outnumber Hindus and make India part of, a Muslim homeland. This is a belief that a lot of, as you said, a lot of right-wing nationalists hold dearly and get energized with. Of course, there's no facts in this. It has never been proven. There have been efforts that have been made by Hindu nationalists to create literature around love jihad. Pamphlets are distributed in a lot of small towns or in Hindu neighborhoods, warning young women about the dangers of love jihad. I actually caught hold of one of those while I was reporting in Nagpur. It was a pamphlet that showed a Muslim man, clearly with, wearing a cap, wearing a skull cap, and driving away a obviously Hindu woman, and then there were three outcomes that were displayed on the cover page. One was selling the woman into prostitution, like illegal trafficking. The third was forcing her to suicide, and the third was domestic abuse. Just really doomsday scenarios, like these pamphlets try to sell these doomsday scenarios to kind of create this paranoia that Hindu men can't be trusted, and they are using their romantic prowess or whatever to lure Hindu women into marriage. So this is a completely bizarre idea that has now gained more and more. It should have stuck to the lunatic fringe of the Hindu right, but sadly over the last few years it has become a mainstream idea that is being seriously discussed in circles everywhere. So now with Monica and Arif, Monica's a Muslim man, Arif, sorry, I'm so sorry. We need to, I have to say that again. Monica is a Hindu woman. Arif is a Muslim man. They fall in love and find themselves stuck with an unwanted pregnancy. Even though abortion is legal in India, they find it, a lot of doctors will be reluctant to perform the surgery. So they decide that it's easiest for them to run away to be together. When they run away to be together, Arif has big dreams about becoming a policeman and, kind of hopes that he will be able to return to his village, in his khaki uniform and, kind of win all the respect and affection of his community that he has craved since he was a small child. But what ends up happening is that their elopement kind of get entangled with the Bajrang Dal. A leader of the Bajrang Dal hears a tip about about their elopement and rallies up a crowd. It leads to an attack on Arif's relatives, a massive demonstration outside the local police station where the crowd is clamoring to bring this couple back home.
And, you know, search parties go fan out across the state to find them and bring them back. It is, you know, it's a really devastating development for Arif, who has dreams of becoming a policeman. It's also a devastating development for Monica, you know, who feels responsible for, you know, all this destruction that has come upon his family. But somehow it is, you know, they find themselves, because when they ran away, they weren't, you know, exactly in the kind of love that they had expected to fall in love with. They weren't exactly in love. You know, through all these kind of rough developments, they find themselves coming closer and, you know, kind of figuring out how to live with, you know, this new reality that is their life.
So maybe now let's kind of take some time to talk about the third relationship in the book, which is Reshma and Preeti. You know, they are different from us in the book. They have a lesbian relationship, which kind of brings in other pressures about tradition, about kind of norms around that. I guess, what's the conversation about LGBT rights in India? Is it different from the conversation about LGBT rights kind of in other places in the world? And then how does that conversation kind of link into Reshma and Preeti's story?
Yeah. So for the past 3 decades, I want to say, there has been a large amount of activism around that has, you know, to call for the dismantling of this colonial era law, Section 377, which conflicts homosexuality with sodomy and bestiality. There's been a huge amount of activism around that. In 2009, the Delhi High Court actually passed a judgment to decriminalize homosexuality. And that was considered a victory for the LGBT rights movement in India. But shortly after that, the ruling was overturned. Finally, in 2018, the Supreme Court of India passed, you know, a verdict that decriminalized, struck down Section 377, which made, for the first time in several decades, being an LGBT person was no longer a crime. This is an interesting thing because homophobia is something that kind of came with colonialism into India. Indian religious texts and mythology brims with references to same-sex love. There are stories of spirits that flow in and out of gendered bodies, make love to people of the same gender. And, you know, it's a very gender fluid tradition, you know, mythologically and spiritually and religiously. But of course, the public life of religious text is not the same as the actual text. So in India, same-sex love is treated as a dirty secret. It's not something that is discussed openly. It is not something that is, you know, even I can't even say it's a taboo, because it's not even given the dignity of being addressed as a real issue. Often, if a young person says that he has feelings for another man, or a young woman says that she has feelings for someone of her own gender, the efforts will be made to push that person into a heteronormative marriage. You know, what are known as, and often young people, even in the diaspora, will enter marriages of convenience where, you know, they marry someone of the opposite sex, but then continue to live their authentic selves in private relationships. So that's essentially what the state is in India. But now with Preeti and Reshma, they come from a part of India which is really far removed from the equal rights movement. You know, even words such as gay, lesbian, LGBT are not really in their vocabulary. The way that they express their love to each other are with phrases and terms that are borrowed from popular culture. The way that they express their love to each other is, you know, things that they see in the movies. For instance, I want to live with you. I want to die with you. I can't imagine a life without you. So that, you know, that's why I wanted to focus on their stories because to me, you know, their story kind of really illustrates the vast divide between what is happening, you know, in terms of policy and policy making and, you know, big debates that are happening in big cities and the private lives of people like Reshma and Preeti, how unaffected they are by it. So when Section 377 gets struck down in New Delhi, Reshma and Preeti are working as room service staff in a temple town named Shirdi. And they actually break out into one of the most bitter fights of their relationships around that time. So while the law has finally recognized them as full human beings who have the rights as any other Indian citizens to choose and be with whoever they like, you know, their private experience is, you know, is still an undoing from, you know, their own ideas of what heteronormative relationships should look like. That is what I hoped I would be able to illustrate by spending time with Reshma and Preeti to just show the big difference of private lives that you know kind of pass in anonymity in small towns and villages.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
You know, speaking of the court, I mean, this is a good segue into my next question, which is kind of what, like, the role that the courts, the legal system, what law enforcement, like the role that they play in at times enforcing a lot of these norms, these prejudices. Definitely, I know for Damodar Neetu, the police are themselves, like they are themselves hesitant to do anything to stop the violent consequences against Dewinder's family. But other times, you know, the courts, maybe the national courts involving the laws against homosexuality, but also police maybe further away in the city center are much more sympathetic to the couples and their families, or the couples and the families who are suffering the consequences of social prejudice. I guess kind of like what, in your view, in reporting the story, kind of what role did the legal system, did law enforcement, did the courts play on either side, both in kind of protecting and preserving these norms, but also at times ruling in favor of the couples and their, I guess, freedom to choose who they want to marry?
Yeah. So I think this is one of the central tensions of this book. India is essentially a place that thrives on two competing systems. One is the state and its laws that promises to protect individual rights, you know, fundamental rights of liberty, dignity, freedom, independence, the right to choice. But on the other hand, there is this invisible, vast system of morality and tradition that has no clear rights and wrongs, but has very clear boundaries. So young people, these young six people are constantly caught up in the push and pull of laws and, you know, that promise one thing and tradition that says the other. In Neetu and Davinder's case, for instance, the policemen that are obliged by law to protect them secretly harbor feelings and thoughts and opinions that side with their families, that they don't really believe that love marriage is should be a choice. They don't believe that they think of it as a selfish act that can upend the lives of families and communities and disturb, you know, the delicate balance on which this society stands. In Arif and Monica's case, it is on one hand, the police that the police in Monica and Arif's story, like, are this shape-shifting form. There is a police officer that sides with the Bajrang Dal and harasses his aunt constantly for more information about where they could be hiding. But then at the end, it is the legal system that provides the final relief when all charges against them are dropped, the kidnapping charges against Arif are dropped, they're given a clean chit to start their lives together. And also, I think there's something to be said that for a man like Arif, his only dream is to become a police officer, because I think he sees it as one of the greatest institutions of secular India. Like, for him, the Indian Constitution is the greatest document ever written, because it promises him the same rights as other members of other religious communities. I think that's a beautiful thing, because he wants to become a police officer to claim those rights, even if reality and day-to-day circumstances constantly teach him something different. Constantly remind him that this is still not the case, that he has the same rights and position as, a Hindu man of his age, for instance. In Reshma and Preeti's story, the law kind of looms large constantly, because, just the fact that a law can wipe out their very identity, a law can say that these are not real feelings and desires, and they're not valid in the eyes of the law, is something that is a really diminishing facet to live with, right? The law in that sense looms large. And at the end, even if the law says something, which is that it is no longer a criminal act to be a person who desires someone of the same gender, the social life of that law is completely different. People around them still believe that it is illegal, it is wrong, it is criminal to love someone of the same gender. So yeah, I think at the essence of this book is this exact push and pull of the law telling you one thing, but tradition telling you something else.
So, all these, in kind of reading your book, all these relationships come under strain, due to social pressure. Their family members are subject to violence by other members of the community. Other members of their family are not as accepting of their relationship, precisely both tradition and also because of the cost to other members of their family. And not every person in the book handles this pressure well. There are a lot of fights, a lot of arguments, in times even verging kind of beyond that into things that are actions that sometimes seem quite troubling. I mean, you met all of these people, you talked, you reported out their story. I mean, could you see kind of the pressure being put on these various people, on these various couples, and how that kind of affected their mental health and kind of the status of their relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things about this book is that the young people that make these choices don't exactly think them through. So they make them very fast, very spontaneously. And then the rest of the book dwells in the space where they're kind of recalibrating with the consequences of those actions. Now, the consequences of those actions really affect them as much as they affect the people around them. So in Neetu and Davinder's case, for instance, Davinder's mother is attacked, is assaulted by Neetu's family. She is physically assaulted, ends up in the hospital with massive injuries, takes months to recover. Their house is destroyed. There is, all their belongings are, kind of robbed and taken away. And most importantly, they cannot even now go back to the village and try to sell the property, which, they had lived in for most of their lives. In Arif and Monica's case, there is the ambushing by the Bajrang Dal, and just this constant threat of his dreams being checkmated by this one act. And in Preeti and Reshma's case, it is a violence that's in very private. So there is this scepter of violence that looms large over all three of these stories and kind of like envelopes not only them, but, their loved ones into it. There is so much anger, so much, regret, sorrow, feelings of betrayal that all of them go through, and their families members go through towards these young people. A lot of them don't find it in themselves to forgive them for running away together, because just the sheer consequences have been so vast.
So I want to end with maybe kind of taking a big picture view, kind of generated from reading these stories. I think there's always a risk when you think about these sorts of norms, these sorts of prejudices. I think especially when it comes to countries like India, there's a risk that I think you read these books and you think it's limited to poor communities, more quote unquote backward communities. And those quotes are very much like there's definitely scare quotes around that. But it feels like it would be perhaps incorrect to kind of assume that I guess these are being relegated out to kind of the countryside, to remote areas. Several of the families in your book, they're comfortable. They're maybe kind of comfortably middle class. I guess how pervasive are these norms, are these beliefs in middle class India and above?
I would argue that these norms and beliefs are pervasive across all sections of Indian society. In some cases, they might be even more in the upper classes, because there's such a emphasis on stature and status that these taboos and the stakes become larger for the middle and upwardly mobile classes. I would say that, especially the prejudices and biases around class, even caste, 100%, community without a doubt, are very much present and pervasive across upper and middle class India.
I mean, have these things changed since you did the lion's share of reporting for your book? Obviously Hindu nationalism at least appears to be much more overt today. But I guess how have these norms and prejudices, have they changed since you did most of the reporting for your book?
I feel like the book I reported and the book, the time at which I reported the book and the time at which this book is coming out, the country's changed. I wasn't fearful reporting this love jihad angle when I was doing the work, but now that it is being released in India, I'm definitely a little nervous. I think that it is, it's just more that there's just a sort of masculine sort of energy around this political movement, this narrative now, and it's greater, louder, more belligerent than it was when I was, even reporting this a couple years ago. Without a doubt, even cops in northern India, I feel, are, If not more powerful than they were then, they're definitely still around. They're definitely still influential. And of course, the biases around same-sex love are as entrenched as they ever were.
So I think with that, that ends our conversation with Mansi Choksi, author of The Newlyweds, Rearranging Marriage and Modern India. Mansi, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And what might be next for you? What might be your next project?
Oh, yeah. So people can find me on my website. It's mansichoksi.com, M-A-N-S-I-C-H-O-K-S-I. It has my email. If you drop me a note, I'll definitely reply. And on Twitter and on Instagram, I'm at mansi_choksi, M-A-N-S-I_C-H-O-K-S-I. I have no idea what I'm doing next. I hope I'm just taking it all in at the moment. But hopefully something exciting will come soon.
Oh no, I mean, hey, people definitely have appreciated when guests on the show say, "I have no idea what's coming up next." They feel like it's a very honest answer.
Yeah, I really have no idea.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's N-I-C-K-R-I-G-O-R-D-O-N. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. This podcast is on favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends if you want to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for more info who's coming up on the show. But before then, Mansi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.